So I'm here today, this is more of a dialogue than a talk, because I really want to, you can see, I have my notebook out and I have many blank pages. So I'd really like to hear from you about what stories you think would be interesting, important, valuable in some way to be seen by the general public on television, and how you might tell that. So just as a little bit of context, the hardest thing that I probably had to learn, and I think that any television producer and a science producer has to learn, is the difference between topic and story. A topic is comprised of a number of interesting facts. It's kind of linear. It's sort of a list. Now, television programs can be a list, and you've probably seen many yourself or many articles, 10 top ideas that change the world, for example. So that's kind of one of our favorite cliches. And that is something that indeed is possible to turn into a television program. But the best kind of programs, and I think the best science programs, are ones that actually tell a story. So what is it that a story means? We discussed it in my first talk a little bit. A story means a narrative that unfolds so that the end is not predictable from the beginning. It's not simply telling you 10 great facts about nanotechnology, or 10 really super people who do experiments in nanotechnology or material science or any one of a number of topics. But it unfolds as a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has conflict in it, it has drama in it, it has excitement in it, and you simply don't wind up in the same place where you started, and it's somewhat surprising to the audience. A story is the hardest thing to define, but all of us know it when we read something or go to see a movie. What do you say when you, if you loved it, that was a great story. And you know exactly what you mean, although you may not be able to define it. We've all been to what's called the McKee Story Seminar, which is you pay, this is the words of wisdom of a screenwriter, kind of a failed screenwriter, I have to say, named Robert McKee. And he tells, he instructs screenwriters on what's called the three-part story structure, which dates all the way back to the ancient Greeks, which is conflict, climax, resolution. And it makes a very neat little package. And for many, many, many years, this was really how I structured stories. Because when you go to one of these story seminars, you start on a Friday night, and you know you're really tired, you've been working all day, you've paid a lot of money from this, and the first thing, and McKee is mean. This is as close to, I've never been to an S seminar or anything, or Scientology or anything like that, but I would imagine this is as close as it gets to that. He first of all tells you that if your cell phone rings, you have to come up and give him $20. And he collects a lot of $20, and you wouldn't dare not to give it to him. If you wish for a talk and he catches you, he kicks you out of the room. He's a mean, mean guy. And he thinks very little of his audience, which is kind of the perfect setup to get you to really become an acolyte of his point of view. He ends up doing an analysis of the movie, frame-by-frame analysis of the movie Casablanca. Mm-hmm. And from an Aristotelian point of view. Now, I don't really know anything about an Aristotelian point of view. I'm just a television producer. Maybe you know. But it is extremely erudite and amazing. And when you get out and you get home, you feel like you have to tell your spouse about it in hours-long detail until you see their eyeballs roll back into the head. You know what I mean when you just feel like you're in the presence of something that really clicks for you in a deep and profound way. Oh, was that someone's cell phone? $20, please. You can do it, I can do it. Anyway, so the first third of the film is conflict. You have to have your character, you have to get your character in trouble and keep them there. That's what happens. Climax, the story just has to come to some kind of a head, which is going to make the whole floor fall out under your character. And then resolution, you have to get to they lived happily ever after, because really nobody wants to see a sad or tragic science film. So the question is, what you're probably saying is, okay, that sounds great for movie or some feature film, but how does this really work for science? But when you really think about it, it does actually work great. And if you think about the movie The Proof that we saw, part of that in my first talk about how Andrew Wiles solved proof for Matt's last theorem, you can see that he is engaged in a terrible conflict with himself in the first part about whether he can do this. He starts off with a childlike belief, fascination with Fermat's last theorem. Then he actually solves it, but his solution, his proof turns out to be wrong. That was perfect. The floor falls out from under him, and then of course he solved it again, and he certainly has lived happily ever after, at least we hope, after spending 7 years of his life doing this. Yes?
I don't deny that such stories exist in science, but that's, I don't think, the norm. And don't we run the danger of, I don't know, confusing archaeology with Indiana Jones if we do that?
You know, I think you have another pathway in your mind. You know, you have, you know, both the rational and the emotional pathways in your mind. So your storytelling pathway is really looking to try to emotionally engage the viewer. But the rational part of your mind says, this has to be correct, this has to be true to reality, this has to be accurate. We can't bend the facts to tell a good story much as you want to. So you're looking at it with kind of two eyes, your two hats, your journalist hat and then your filmmaker hat. And so I agree with you, you know, and scientists hate being turned into actors, and I can't blame them. One of the first films I made was called The Gene Engineers on recombinant DNA after Sylmar way back in 1978. I really didn't know what I was doing. And I directed the Nobel laureate Paul Berg, and he really got mad at me because he felt that I was turning him into an actor, and he didn't like it. I don't think I was. I think I was just trying to get him to really speak in a way that the audience could follow and understand and engage with. But that was certainly a story about conflict, a time when a group of biologists believed, you know, had come up with a brilliant new technology to splice DNA, and yet they themselves feared that this technology could do great harm. Turned out, of course, that it couldn't, and now it's one of the major paradigm shifts and advances in biological science of our time. But at that time, we didn't know that's how it would be, that most of their fears would be groundless. So the idea is, and I think to say to take your point, and then we're going to talk about some stories, is that it all comes with the story choice. One, before I took this job as executive producer of NOVA, the guy who had been, John Angier, who had been the executive producer of NOVA, had been my boss as a NOVA producer when I started as just a production assistant. He said to me, in this job, you really don't have that much to do, which I don't know how he did it, but that didn't turn out to be. But you have a few really super important decisions to make every year. And those are the shows that you're going to make. And if you make a mistake on those decisions, you are really going to suffer for it, because you have to live with it for a long time, because these shows take a year or more to make. So it is true. And a lot of programs that have a very hard time being born, it's because the topic was not properly vetted, or because we thought the story was one thing and it turned out to be another, or because it turned out that there was not too much story at all. And unfortunately, sometimes you don't know that until you've gotten deeply into the research. In the old days, when we had tons of money, if we started research on a film and it didn't really turn out to pan out, that the story wasn't what we thought it was, and we didn't feel it was doable, we could dump it. But now we have to salvage pretty much everything. And I can just tell you that you have a very sinking feeling when you know that you're heading into something that really is not going to work as a subject. Now, occasionally that's because you just run into a situation where the science is just so difficult that it's just daunting, and that figuring out a way to tell the story is just extremely difficult. Usually with those kinds of stories, we can usually make our way through it with a lot of help from our scientist advisors, a lot of use of metaphor. But sometimes, often, something turns out to be just a topic, just kind of a list, and it's just kind of boring. But that doesn't mean that people won't want to watch it, because people who are really interested in the topic might. But it won't be a good film, even if people watch it. Yes?
But there are other ways to tell a story. For example, mm-hmm. Coming when there's a flashback. Mm-hmm. So the way that builds interest is quite different, because you sort of know the outcome frequently. If they were to find out the background.
That would be appropriate for some science stories, I would think, because people have seen things
or know about consequences of certain technological developments.
Mm-hmm.
But how it came about is interesting.
Right. And I, to take your point, I think almost all of the stories that we tell are flashbacks, because we are seldom following developments prospectively, because it's simply too much of a risk. And because if you don't know how it's going to turn out, often you don't know if it's going to turn out or whether there's a story. So I'll give you a, but the thing is, you can't really assume that the public knows it. The people in the field might know it. And so we almost all, but that's a small number of people, not often, even though our audience is an educated audience that follows science, I've actually never had a complaint that said, you know what, I knew this story. Why did you tell it to me as though I didn't know it? I've gotten all kinds of complaints from people, as you can imagine. But, for example, in my next talk, my final talk on June 25th, I'll be talking about controversy in science. And one of the topics that we're going to cover is the controversy over evolution, which is not so much a controversy within science as it is a controversy between science and the almost half of the American public who does not really believe in Darwinian evolution. And we told the story in 2007 about a trial that took place in Dover, Pennsylvania in 2005. And of course, the outcome was well known. It had been all over the New York Times, everything. We told it from the perspective that you don't know the outcome of this. And so, and again, no one complained. And I'm sure some of the people who knew this, who watched the program, actually, and it took, this was a 2-hour program, so it took like a long time to kind of get to the end of it when you finally found out Judge Jones's ruling. And that doesn't seem, I think that even people who might know about it are willing to suspend their knowledge for a little while to, because they're engaged and involved in the story. And of course, that's our goal, is to make them do that. But to your point, of course, there are many different ways to tell a story. And one thing that I was going to say is the three-part structure has now fallen out of fashion because you have audiences that have much less of an attention span. Everybody is, you know, when we started broadcasting almost 40 years ago, you know, people had a lot of time. The family sat down around the television set and watched the show together. Now families have a television set for every person, and the kids are watching on the computer or doing Facebook or whatever. And I'm not saying we still have a lot of families that view together, and of course that's indeed what we want. But very few people, if you think, if any of you watch television, if you think of your own viewing habits, you have your computer on your lap, probably. You may be folding laundry. You might have the TV on in the kitchen when you're cleaning up after dinner. Everybody is multitasking. People are telling us, you know what, I don't want to wait till the end of the story to know what happens. I need to know up front that this story is worth an hour of my time. These audiences are tough. I need to know that. And of course, when you go, I don't know if you've ever had experience with focus groups, but they're a nightmare. And, you know, a bunch of people who will give up their evening to get $75 and a slice of pizza go in, and they love to cut what you do to shreds. So you kind of, if you're watching from the other side of a one-made mirror, you get to see your life's work torn apart by a bunch of people you don't even know. And frankly, you kind of hate and disdain after a while. But they're your public. So usually when we do focus groups, we divide them into people who always watch Nova, and there's nothing we can do wrong. They love everything we do. We love them. People who sometimes watch Nova, and those, of course, are the people that we're most anxious to listen to, and people who say they will never watch Nova, and we would like to understand why. And all of these people are sort of remotely within our demographic, at kind of around the educational level, income level, well, usually not income level, because PBS viewers a lot of money, but you can't get those people to go to focus group for an evening. And so, but they tell us, you need to tell me something at the beginning. Give me a taste of what I'm going to learn so I know. And that caused us to move away from McKee's story structure and more into an episodic structure, which if you look at the evolution of our shows, if anybody's interested enough to do that, you can see that we're still doing that, but we're trying to shoehorn it in to some kind of concept of a story. And this is a new thing for us. I don't think we're completely there yet, but it's an attempt to accommodate what the attention span of the American public is now. So those are the things that I think are important. Storytelling. How are you just not going to make this a list of ideas? Second of all, visuals. It's got to have some kind of visual possibility. You actually have to be able to see something in the show, and not all with animation. Because if you have all animation, and I'm talking especially about graphic animation, the kind we saw in Encyclopedia Britannica films in high school, not that much fun to watch. Animation that's metaphor, that is imaginative, that's also very expensive. So you have to figure out what whether you have the money. So it needs to have visuals, it needs to have a story, and it needs to have characters. People that the audience, people like to watch shows about people. And so it needs to have characters that you can engage with, whose thinking process you can understand. Because a program like NOVA, we're not interested in presenting science as a bunch of answers. Kind of, we're delivering, you're so lucky because we're delivering truth to you all tied up in a pretty package. We want it to be as messy as possible, because that's where the drama is. And then we'd like to tie it in a knot through the intellectual process of the character. So those are kind of the thing that when producers come to pitch me, or scientists pitch me, or we get ideas in from the public, or from other journalists, or from reading them in the New York Times, or the New Yorker magazine, we're always saying, okay, what's the story here? What's the story? Nothing's wrong with starting with the topic, but you have to move on to what's the story, what am I going to see? Probably the most important question of all, why should I care? Well, what relevance does this have to me? Now, that doesn't mean for our audience that the relevance has to be that this is going to be a great new washing machine, that it's going to wash the clothes in 4 minutes instead of 15. I don't think our audience has a utilitarian view of science at all. I don't think, in fact, our audience hates science you can use. They hate health programming. If I want sure death, I put on a medical program. They do not want to see it. We have a largely male audience. They do not want to watch programs about cancer and Alzheimer's disease. I don't exactly know why. And when we do medical programs, the female part of our audience, as we say, we have, our business manager always says, yes, we have a lot of female viewers, but they're actually like men. Which is probably a sexist thing for me to say, but I think it's so funny that I always say. So when we did, for example, Cracking Your Genetic Code about personalized medicine at the end of March, it was a lovely program, very high female viewership, the men abandoned it in droves. They want to see it. So, and I know, you know, I have a husband, I see him clicking around and surfing, and he's like, yuck. You know, I don't want to be depressed. I don't want to watch programs about sick people. So, and that's one of the constants that we have to deal with. But what I really want in this session is I'd love to hear about some of your ideas, and I'd like to kind of press you if you have some topic ideas, some story ideas, and I'll push you to work with me to develop them into some kind of story. So you can see some of the process that we go through. And I can tell you one thing, it often takes me at least and my team a long time from getting an idea to when we make a decision to actually go with it. Because we know that it's a good idea, and it's something new, it's something hot, it's something important. We really like the scientists that it involves. Can't figure out how to tell the story. And sometimes those things just take a lot of time, and there's nothing you can do about it. You've got to mull it over and think it over and read a lot of articles on it and try to sort out a way to tell a story. I've been sitting on this show on cybersecurity, which I really want to do. I like the producers. I know that they know a lot about it. I've been sitting on it for about 8 months now. And in fact, now, of course, the story has moved on and left us behind, but just can't figure out how to tell the story. Anyway, you have an idea, which I'd love to hear.
I don't know, maybe it's already been used, but I think the story of graphene is remarkable. It's like Cinderella story. Mm-hmm. It's a material which presumed not to exist. Uh-huh. People find it a very low-tech, you know, scotch tape thing, and boom, I mean, thousands of papers, Nobel Prize, I mean, and technological promise. Mm-hmm. I think it has all the elements you want.
Uh-huh. So do you think graphene is a story that it did make it in?
Has it been already featured in the novel?
It was about a 6-minute segment in our series on material science, Making Stuff. So the question is, does graphene make an hour-long documentary? Is it a shorter piece? Or is it something that you put in a context of a larger documentary with a bigger story area? What do you think?
Well, I mean, you can, if you want to tell it as a story, you can make it as long as you want. So there's some, as I said, we know all sorts of carbon materials, but this was sort of magically missing. People were sort of, didn't believe it existed or could be made.
So just give me a little bit of the once upon a time story here.
Well, okay, I mean, I'm not a storyteller.
That's okay.
So
I'll fill in the blanks. I'm asking it because I think it will be instructive, and other people who know about the graphene story can chime in. Let's see if we can, as an exercise, let's see if we can flesh this out. You know, here I'm thinking, okay, one development within a bigger field, how do I blow this up into a story? So I'd love to hear, you know, a little bit more about, you say, magical twists and turns. Tell me some of them, or someone else who you all know. Do you all know this story?
Was there controversy about Nobel Prize or two? That could be it.
Oh yeah, so I guess there's also tension about who really discovered it, right? There several people hoping to, you know, to be acknowledged, and maybe not all of them got. I mean, I think still it was a fair decision by the Nobel Committee, but still. So there's this kind of personal tension there as well. And now, as I said, it's an enormous.
So, you know, the key to what you're saying to me is there was something missing and no one could find it. And so can someone tell me more about that? Because that's where I looked for the story. That's where I looked at. Here's something
that. The way is to look at it from dimensionality. We have, you know, carbon. So graphene is, of course, made up of carbon. And we know, you know, simple carbon like diamond and graphite, you know, ancient time. And then I think,
so someone in the expert correct me how the nanotubes come in, 1980, 70?
91, I think.
So then, of course, there's the boom of, you know, getting devices smaller and smaller and nanotechnology. And then I think in the 1990s, as the expert said, there is discovery of 1D structure, you know, nanotubes. Basically, you know, you go up. A tube, but then they can even get down to a different size, you know, different type, and then you can think of if you have, you know, a sheet, a tube is a small thing, so you can blow it up, then you in the limit to this structure, but that is not discovered until when graphene is 2000.
Right, and in terms of visuals, you can, I mean, this another name for this carbon structure is fullerenes, right? So it's related to this.
So there's also zero.
Related to buckyballs, exactly.
So there's 0D, which is the buckyball, and then 1D, which is the nanotube, and then 3D, which is Asian graphite. But somehow the 2D, which you just get from, you know, having a tube of, you know, infinite diameter, that's somehow missing.
What, I don't understand, what's missing?
The graphene is the 2D, right? Graphite is 3D structure of carbon. And then the buckyball is kind of, you can think of it as a zero-dimensional thing, right? Because it's, all the dimensions are small, right? It's just four small dimension. And then nanotube extend in one direction, right? So it's a 1D. And then the 2D is missing. The graphene, which is 2D, is missing.
So everyone thinks that you should be able to find this or create this, right?
Maybe you don't know the story how it was discovered.
Yeah, I don't.
Okay, so let me tell you, it's fantastic.
Okay, good. I'm all ears.
Because this is nanotechnology. It's making an atomically thin layer. And you know how it was made? With scotch tape.
Yeah, oh, I've seen that, yes.
Right? It's extremely low-tech solution, and it worked. Amazingly, it worked. And how we discovered it, how we detected it in the lab, by looking into it. With ordinary optical microscope. Because the condition was just so, happened to be, like, all the stars were aligned, we used the correct substrate, we saw it with the naked eye. So it's amazing. You can see atoms, basically, atomic things. You can make them with, you know, in a school lab. Well, not really, but okay. And then see it with you know, $100 microscope.
And so, and what's the implication of that?
The implication is this material has so many superlative points. It's like the strongest material on Earth. it's how many times struggle and steel, it conducts electricity very well. It's structurally perfect in small system. Mm-hmm. It conducts heat. It's one of the best heat conductors, so it may be solution for all these things in electronics and heat management.
Let me challenge you on that. Come on, graphite. The problem is it conducts really well in the plane, but it doesn't conduct well in three dimensions.
And you don't need to.
And I've heard so many people, yes, you do need to get the third dimension. And
what are you making?
I've heard so many people talk about nanotubes and buckyballs and everything, and they're just, which is just as strong as graphene, by the way, right?
No, the buckyballs never deliver. There's lots of hype about buckyballs and nanotubes, we never deliver.
Precisely.
There's our conflict. Yes.
I just want to say there are a couple of other dimensions. The guy that discovered this, Andre Gein, is a character.
Mm-hmm. He's actually quite interesting.
He's an interesting person.
Mm-hmm. Where is he?
He's now in England, but he was based in Holland before that. He's Russian. Original. He got the Ig Nobel Prize. He's a fascinating individual. So I think that's what part of what you're looking for. Iconoclastic. Otherwise, you would never happen on this, I think. The other dimension is that some applications are already appearing. For example, flexible monitors. You know, you can display like your flat screen was a revolution over the old tube-based TV. But you can already have materials that's flexible on which you can display images. So some of these things are even stuck in magazines already. And I mean, the potential is there, and people are.
The potential is there for a kind of applications that are.
Lots of applications, and that's why there's so much money going into the research, not just in the academia, but also in industry.
Right.
It's going to be a big industry, and you can see that. You don't know exactly.
Right.
Exactly what it'll be.
But of course, when we do a show, we want there to be applications that will change the world in a way, and that will be uplifting, not just another consumer product that people will make a bundle on.
Okay, how about this application? I don't know the exact story, but Antonio Castraneta was telling me that graphene is biocompatible. It's carbon. And so he was telling me about a doctor who was using graphene to connect this little camera to the blind people's retina. So the graphene is helping to blind people see again. How about that?
That's uplifting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another connection, actually.
Oh, it's medical, unfortunately.
Another connection.
We don't have to say that.
To other physics is that graphene has this funny property that electrons behave like relativistic particles. Mm-hmm. So we lose their mass. Electrons magically lose their mass. Mm-hmm. How does it happen? And then behave as, sort of like mimic the behavior of, ultra high energy particles. Uh-huh. Well, not really, but,
Like I say, you're really intriguing me.
As far as applications are concerned, this is not the question when people like Nova have to figure out how to do this. I granted there is no shortage of super cool applications that people have proposed for graphene, and there's an unbelievable hype in the field.
Right.
I personally think 99% of this is oversold.
Of course.
If you now jump on that bandwagon.
Do you think nanotubes are oversold and buckyballs?
Well, there's a lot of things. You can't say a nanotube is an unbelievably strong material, which is true if you look at a single nanotube, but a single nanotube is very small and it can't hold much of a weight. So you need to make a big fiber or cable with this thing, and that's not nearly as stable. You can't just scale it up. There's lots of things that people or if I take this application and make people see, I mean, there's a lot more you need for a retina than something that I've mentioned. Mm-hmm. And my fear is, when, and these things have happened before and before and before, that you go over the hype, you oversell something, you increase expectations of people into like the next miracle thing, and it's going to fall through. And if this happens over and over and over again, people are going to lose their faith in science. This is not
right.
How science works, okay? Let people figure out whether the hype delivers before you say, we have the next miracle coming around the corner. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff that is amazing and cool about graphene, but it's... I don't think it is that I might be able to see in 10 years. I would clearly not use these applications to excite people.
Mm-hmm. So I can see there's a lot of conflict in this topic too, which I think is actually good. And I really think your point about when things are hyped up through applications, I think that what our audience really likes and what I really like is not just hyping topics through applications. What I meant was uplifting is that they really advance knowledge and understanding. Our audience is different from other audiences because they're not that wowed by gee-whiz gadgets. What they are wowed about is adding to the state of knowledge. We're very lucky to have such an audience that is as deep as that. It really is wonderful, but we have to satisfy that. So,
okay, so do you think they'd be interested in the connection to the graphic station?
To what?
Yes. So that is part of my worry, mm-hmm. is when you talk about, you know, how when you talk about how the electronic graphene looks like the, you know, high energy particles, mm-hmm. There's a tendency of that being, you know, cartoonish presentation in the popular science community that suggests too much.
People
tend to really believe that there is some, you know, high energy physics you can.
I don't know. It's certainly not.
They draw an equation of, you know, what the electrons in the graphene is and the elementary particle is, and that is an easy trap that you can get into.
I mean, there's a limit to how deep you can go in this, but I do think that our audience is most interested in the basic science and how this, if it does bring about any kind of a paradigm shift or really grow the understanding, that's what they're most interested in, more than gee-whiz applications, although that would naturally be a part of the program too.
Well, if you'd be happy to tell a bit more of the theory side of the story, then the story starts 50 or 60 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And you would say, once upon a time, there was a theoretician, the name of which escapes me, unfortunately, who got curious into the behavior of two-dimensional materials and started to do some calculations on stuff such as two-dimensional carbon. And he found all these amazing properties that this material would have, and everyone else will laugh and say, yeah, two-dimensional stuff, we're never going to be able to make that. But then 50 years later, someone made that stuff, and indeed all these behaviors are there, it's really true. But it took 50 years to sort of, in that sense, verify that theoretical idea wasn't just all just pie in the sky. Mm-hmm. But I mean, when people now go ahead, look, we have this material, we found all these things, the truth really is it was known for 50 years it would have that stuff. The only thing we didn't have is
the stuff
in our hands.
Yeah, that makes a great story because then you close the loop at the end.
Yeah, but the unfortunate thing is that the person who figured out all of this stuff, I can't even remember the name of that guy.
Well, so you were saying it was Williams, and I've seen Anslager had notes about the behavior.
Mm-hmm. Wallace.
What I'm talking about.
Wallace.
Yeah, we're going to have a rapid response workshop, a 2-week workshop next December, mm-hmm. on one aspect of it, which is related to the Dirac equation. It's a special application which was discovered, predicted by Majorana many years ago. It's also an interesting character, historically. Mm-hmm. He predicted there could be a kind of elementary particle that's never been seen, but it seems that its analog in some solids may exist. And right now there's controversy about the experimental results. Mm-hmm. Maybe by December it will be resolved. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's an area where we're investing intellectually here. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is going to go away in a short time.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's a rich subject that could...
It's a great subject.
Right.
From the point of view of principle, even if the applications are overhyped, which may or may not be the case, from the point of view of principle, there's a great deal of interest.
Okay, so who has another idea? Yeah.
So you had these two Brian Green specials on the unification of gravity, or the conflict between gravity and quantum mechanics, which I guess have been successful. And you can remember who Brian, I understand. And there's one piece of terms he's never told, but it's sort of had a big impact, which is in 1976, Stephen Hawking wrote this paper saying that if you look at quantum mechanics near black holes, it fails. The fundamentals of quantum mechanics fail. And this is something which pretty much everyone who works in this field of gravity and energy physics has felt compelled to think about. And Steve and Marty and I have each spent lots of time trying to find Hawking's mistake and failing. And really over the years, the consensus that formed is that something radical has to happen. So that this thought experiment of Hawking points to something very radical. Not necessarily the failure of quantum mechanics, but maybe a radical change in how we think about space-time.
Let me just say. So you agree or disagree with Hawking that quantum mechanics breaks down?
I agree that his thought experiment says that something fundamental has to break down, but not on what breaks down.
Mm-hmm. Well, Hawking disagrees with Hawking.
Well, I mean, so Hawking
famously recanted, but there is no good explanation given for his recanting.
Right, so there is conflict because, right, for many years there were strong opinions on both sides of this, and as Steve says, Hawking, about 10 years ago, 8 years ago, changed his mind. The beginning is sharp. Hawking wrote this paper. The end is in some ways it's still ongoing. We just had this program here in which people are trying to understand this issue. In some ways the central issue is kind of abstract. Although again, it's important because it's what is quantum mechanics.
Well, it's a challenge to the foundations of current physics. The most basic foundations of current physics are in conflict.
So it led to...
Can you just elaborate on that for a second?
Well, so we have a way of describing basically all phenomena at the underlying level we see in nature in terms of what's called quantum field theory. Mm-hmm. And quantum field theory is based on some principles, quantum mechanics, locality, notion that things that are separated don't immediately communicate, and basically the principle of relativity, special relativity, which involves a mathematical apparatus. Those are the principles that underlie quantum field theory. And when you try to think about what happens with black hole evaporation, it seems to lead to a conflict between those basic principles. One of them or more has to be wrong. And so that could be, it looks to many of us, as if it is, as big as the set of problems that occurred at the turn of the 20th century. When classical physics looked great, it described everything nearly perfectly, except, there were these little problems here and there with the atom and stability and various other things. And by the time we finished unraveling that story, classical mechanics had been completely overthrown, and quantum mechanics had to be invented to...
Do you think this is as big as that? I mean, looking back, that looks pretty big, right?
Sure does.
Like, super big.
I don't know if others feel this way, but it certainly...
You all think that way?
We don't have the resolution to the story yet. That's the one problem with the storyline.
This is one challenge, is that we may be seeing... we have some indications, possibly, about the resolution, but the full resolution is not yet complete.
One of the outcomes is this holographic. is the holographic principle.
Well, and there's controversy there.
You know, I have to say, I put up with Brian through all of string theory, where he's telling me that time doesn't really exist, all this other stuff that's really bending my mind. But the holographic theory, that was like almost too much for me. It was kind of a last minute addition. I was like,
almost too much for some.
But people loved it.
Yeah, which shows you don't always need to know the outcome.
No. In fact, it's better to speculate, don't you think? You don't have to, it doesn't have to be
true. Yeah, you said earlier you don't do prospective things, but this is far removed from applications.
So, Joe, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
I'm still thinking. I mean, there's one piece of, so for Brian, you had his books, there's one piece of source material here. Lenny Susskind, who is one of the main people who sort of did the alternative view to Hawking, has this book, The Black Hole Wars, My Battles to Make the World Safe, My Battles with Stephen Hawking to Make the World Safe for Quantum Mechanics. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I think I just looked this up, it's 160,000 on the Amazon list, so he doesn't write as well as he speaks. Okay. But,
Well, you could say that the solution he advocates, you know, there are a certain number of people who buy that, but it's not sorted out, and no, it's not uncontroversial as well.
Right, but the holography is something which certainly is true at some mathematical. I mean, maybe a CFT is a true thing.
We're trying to figure out what it means.
Right. But it could be, you know, I don't want to get too technical, one is using it to calculate, you know, what's seen in heavy ion collisions. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is actually a time experiment at the very end.
That's applied ABS here.
Right, but it's using
controversy.
It's surprising.
Well, see, I want to tell you something. On this topic, I'm sold. And why am I sold? You know, I'm sold because I feel like it's a huge idea. And I think our viewers love big ideas, and I kind of like them too. So even though I have to admit, from the journalistic perspective, I mean, it would take much more digging. It's going to take a lot of money because it's a very, it would be a very graphics-rich show. But this is a huge idea. And when you say things like we could be entering a time like that when we realize that classical mechanics is breaking down, that kind of gets my juices flowing, I have to say. So you can start to see how an executive producer really thinks, because it sounds like a program for the age.
How would you develop a complex idea like this? I mean.
Well, I called Joe McMaster, first of all, and say, okay, here's a really interesting topic that I think you could handle. You have to have someone who can handle the topic, someone who, not necessarily a scientist, but somebody who feels comfortable in this terrain, who can deal with Lenny, mm-hmm. who is a character too, but not the easiest person in the world to deal with, and who can figure out a way to develop this into a story. But the public loves black holes. It tickles the imagination. You really want to think about it a lot. And I know it's in the wheelhouse of our audience. So what I would do is, for this one, because, you know, a lot of this is instinct and experience. You can kind of feel a good story. So I can feel, like the graphene one, I'm really listening to what you say, but I still need to be convinced that, don't yell at me, okay, but that it's more than a kind of a cool application. I need to see the big idea aspect of it to feel that I can make more than a segment of it. That doesn't mean, first of all, I'm wrong a lot of the time. Second of all, I can play with an idea for several months and then come to the conclusion that we should do it. Because I don't understand enough about it, I don't know enough about it, which is certainly the case with graphene. This one, because I went to some of the talks and I heard them and I talked to you, it's kind of a more familiar idea to me. But that big idea aspect of it makes me love it. And love is important because you have to live with these things for a long time. And I think, do I actually want to watch, you know, I'll want to walk into a screening on this topic? Because I have to live with these and watch them over and over and over again. And the answer for me is yes. And happily, it is for my audience, too. So I would try to answer your question more directly. I would get a producer I feel could handle the content. And then he would start talking to you and find the story. Then somewhere after maybe 4 or 5 weeks of research, he would write a concept paper, which answers the basic question, what's the story here? What am I going to see? And who are the characters? And at that point, on a story like this, we'd probably make a definite decision to go ahead. Because it's pretty cheap to have somebody work for a month. But that's how I would, and I would read it. I'd get Lenny's book. I'd look at it. But it wouldn't be too hard to sell. And there's a tremendous fallback because you can always go in the other direction with black holes, which I know would work.
Also, there's another tie-in, which is to the beginning of the universe, inflationary cosmology, and so on. Unraveling these principles and these laws, which, again, we seem to...
Did you say that's a tie-in because it's a similar kind of singularity? Is that...
Yeah, it gets into the basic issues of the quantum mechanics of gravity, which we have to deal with to start at the beginning, as well as the interior of the black hole.
And the conditions would be the same in the Big Bang, is that, or
not identical, but similar.
So
there are similar mathematical issues. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Can I challenge you a little bit on
absolutely.
This?
Absolutely.
With all due respect to my colleagues, but it's programs such as this which always occasionally put me off NOVA, I think, for the following reasons. There's various reasons for this. One of the reasons has to do with something that Feynman once said when he was giving popular lectures and I was being asked all kinds of questions by people, and he was amazed at all these questions from these people coming like, what's happening at the edge of the universe? What's the beginning of time? What's the latest efforts in unifying gravity with quantum mechanics? These questions. And he was always like, why do you want to know these things? You don't even know anything about all the stuff we already know something about. Why do you always ask me things about stuff we don't know anything about? That's one thing. The other thing is, since we are at the edge...
So you're kind of taking issue with this whole big idea.
I'm sort of taking... I like big ideas, but as Marx so nicely pointed out, we don't know the answer yet. We do know the answer to the quantum mechanics story, so that's why we can tell a happy ending. Mm-hmm. Right now what's happening, and I see these too many times in these shows, and Brian Greene does the very same thing. When we're coming to the edge of what we know, we start to speculate. So there's a huge amount of speculation that goes there. And every time I see a quantum mechanics story, and then someone tells me entirely confidently about, let's say, multiverses and parallel universes, as if this is established stuff in the community, I'm being ticked off because it's not. But it's being told as if every scientist agrees that, yes, that's the way of doing it. And again, Feynman would say there's more than one way to skin a cat. So
you can come for my controversy in science talk, because we're going to talk about that. So you can join David and really...
No, but if evolution is the topic, then the problem is that kind of there's a disconnect between science and the rest of the population. Okay. Here the thing is, so the scientists don't need to agree what the right answer is, and those are all very fascinating questions. Mm-hmm. Well, my wonder is that there's this entire universe of physics that's exciting, and the ordinary person on the street knows like that much about it. But what we're going to tell them about it is the outermost fringes we are not quite sure.
But that would be a failed program, I think. And here's what I think is, you have to ask a question that resonates to the audience. Television is voluntary. No one makes you sit down and watch it. This isn't school. You don't have to watch the program. It's not an assignment. So you have to ask a question. When I talked about relevance before, relevance to us is not a gadget. Relevance for my viewers is you have to ask something that engages the audience intellectually for some people, emotionally for other people, but in some way engages them. You only use that question and that kind of big idea as a portal, as a doorway to get in. And if you're not presenting some actual physics in it, you're not actually telling the audience about some aspects of the science, and you're not telling them something about the process of thinking about it, how do scientists actually think about it, and even the controversy, then you've failed in the program. Then it's a program about philosophy or religion or something like that, or just kind of bullshit. And so I don't really like those kind of programs. But I think that you have to frame the topic in a way that people feel that you are giving them, you're meeting them where they are. And that is, people do think about these things.
Well, that would be one of my questions. I mean, clearly you have to make a program that people want to watch. So there are two things you can do. You either can ask people, well, what are you interested in? And then undoubtedly, that's what they're going to be interested in. Mm-hmm. Or do you decide, well, also, I mean, what should they be interested in? And then you try to make a program that they will be interested in this kind of stuff. There's so much stuff out there which matters for their daily life, for their voting habits, for all kinds of things that involve science. They know very little about.
Well, here, I mean, you have examples in climate change, for example. I was just at the National Academies, and they had a conference, a two-day conference featuring social scientists, which is an enormous departure for the National Academies. But it was about how do you frame climate change so that people will think about it. Because it totally failed so far. It's just not on anyone's radar screen. Well, it's on some people's radar screen, California probably more than most, but it's not on most people's radar screen. It's just not a preoccupation to most people. And that's, and I know we've done 13 programs on some aspect of climate change, and universally no one watches them.
In some sense, I mean, this is special because it's such a controversial topic.
Right. Well, now what the social scientists would tell you is we just haven't framed it right. You have to frame it correctly. So people don't want to think that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. They just, that's, it's like thinking about cancer and Alzheimer's. They just don't want to think about it. So how can you frame it? You can frame it, and I don't know if they're right, and I'm not defending the social scientists, as here's a new way we can improve our economy by creating green energy. They try to frame it in, or for the fundamentalists who are often against climate change, we, our responsibility to God is to have stewardship of our earth. So they're thinking that it's all in the way you frame it. I personally haven't found that because I've framed these 13 shows just about every way you can frame them. Nobody watches them, so it's like I haven't succeeded in that. So I'm not sure whether, you know, the American public, they're actually not stupid, and so it's hard to fool them. But what I'm saying is, I think if you frame shows around big questions, whether or not you can answer them, it gives a, and if those questions are slightly more philosophical, or as philosophical, if they're a language that people can understand. You know, if I start out talking about Hawking radiation, nobody's going to watch my program. They don't know what it is, and they don't know how to think about it. You have to meet them where they are, hold their hand, and walk through a topic that is going to be very difficult. But I agree with you in the sense that if you're not presenting some basic physics along the way, and you're not showing the process of thinking about this, then your program, I hate those programs too. I do, I really do.
I think there's some sort of sense that it's much easier to hook audiences on high energy and astronomy as opposed to condensed matter. And those of us in condensed matter, I think, sometimes feel unfairly underappreciated because, you know, somehow you say, oh, the beginning of time, and sort of everyone says, you know,
oh, wow,
but, you know. Plastics, well, hey, you know,
everyone loves that. Everyone loves that iPod.
People loved it. They went crazy making stuff. They loved it. Who would ever think that a series on material science could work? I didn't even know what it was when we started it. So, I want everybody to be heard. Are there other topics that are burning in your hearts? Yes.
You're talking about climate, but climate prediction is something that people care about. And it's connected, of course, to chaos and the butterfly effect and so forth. And there was an article in yesterday's Los Angeles Times, I guess, about this incredibly massive new computer and calculations that are going to be done in where's Wyoming or Montana or somewhere?
They have a computer in Montana?
And it's going to contribute to global warming.
Weather or climate prediction?
Climate, I trust.
Well, yeah, I suppose both, but it's particularly catastrophic climatic events like hurricanes. But not only that.
That's interesting. That might be a good way in.
You might want to explore how important hurricanes are, in fact, or whether there's any relation between hurricanes and global warming.
Right. I'm teaching a class in which
global warming is like, we have 3 hours about global warming, and I spend almost all of that time just debunking some of the stuff that people bring up as evidence for global warming in the everyday discussion, which are not evidence for global warming. And the terrible thing about this is that it's known to the scientists that they're not evidence for global warming, but if it's told by some advocates of the thing, and then someone else debunks that, then everyone thinks, okay, now global warming is debunked. We just had brought up very bad evidence on the table. So you have to bring the right evidence to the table, and the right evidence is difficult. So you need to think of it.
So are you a confident skeptic?
No, I'm not a skeptic. Did it sound like a skeptic? Well, I could come up with a whole bunch of examples that are being issued on the street on a regular basis as support for climate change, which are wrong. And everyone in the field who is a climate scientist knows they are wrong. It's a terrible disservice to the debate to bring these things over and over again. A good example is this. Antarctica is melting. Isn't that terrible? Yeah, but every model we have about climate change should predict that there should be more snow in Antarctica, not less snow. So the fact that Antarctica is melting contradicts every prediction we have about it. It's an embarrassing thing. Right? So we can't go ahead and say...
What about Greenland glaciers?
I know much less about Greenland. Uh-huh. I just made one example. One thing that we could make about this global warming thing is, rather than just the usual thing about how bad it all is, how difficult it is really to come up with a good view about it. And that, I think we do have a view about it, but it's much more subtle, and it relies on a lot of very careful thinking and modeling in order to understand. It's not nearly as clearly said as like 100% or 0%, but the IPCC has put confidence levels on their data. It's not all sure. I mean, these are pretty scary confidence levels, which means you probably would have to act. If I said, you're probably going to die tomorrow with 80% accuracy, you'd probably do something about it and not say, oh, let's get a second opinion and a third and a fourth. Because 80% is still large. You can't just say, oh, I'm not going to do anything about it. But why we believe in these things is much more complicated. And a lot of people who act as just want to dismiss the whole climate problem, they just have an easy job of just picking a little tidbit here, a little tidbit here, and tearing it down. And the public thinks, oh, well, that means the whole thing is torn down. Scientists have all this bogus information. Scientists know that there's much, I mean, a lot of stuff in
But you say yourself that the scientists are giving us evidence for global warming, things that are really questionable.
Well, no, things which come with error bars, things that which come with uncertainty. A lot of this has to do with appreciating uncertainties in modeling, uncertainties in data, disagreement about how to analyze an unbelievably complex set of data. It's not just someone looked through a microscope and bam, there's the answer. This is really, really complicated. So data analysis is a major part of the story. So if someone has a different data analysis than someone else, and people are hitting on each other because you should never do it like this, and then you're falsifying your data. No, I have a different analysis model.
Well, the whole thing with the word trick, wasn't it?
Yeah,
trick those in these emails that got some trick to analyze something, and
we have to talk about this more afterwards. Because I think that level of disagreements and this whole issue of uncertainty is extremely confusing to the public and creates a lot of distrust. And I think it's one of the reasons why the climate issue it's a real failure of communication. Because I think the public feels that the scientists aren't really being straight with them.
Because it doesn't also help with the politicians lying on the House floor.
It's the smoking thing all over again. It's going to take 20, 30 years to work itself. Mm-hmm.
So does anybody have an idea that they're sitting on that?
I don't have an idea, but I'm just very annoyed by
the comments that the cancer doesn't make a good program, because having people in the mathematics of cancer workshop right now.
Right. I didn't say it didn't make a good program. I said it's hard to get people to watch it.
But it seems to me that, you know, like when you really look into cancer, you actually find, like, you know, kind of similarity between developmental process, which you bring kind of really biology into the focus, I think. Mm-hmm. So you kind of dig deep into what's happening, mm-hmm. and you find out, like, some aspects of development biology that is really important in cancer. That's one thing. But the other thing is that if you kind of look cancer from totally different aspects, looking at, like, you know, physical principles or pressures, and come up with totally different ideas, which might actually bring, like, uplifting treatments or something like that that might influence people's lives, you know. That doesn't make any sense.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's because I think you deal with basics of biology, and now biology meets physics.
Right.
It should be, the potential should be there to make a really interesting program. Now, development and biology is actually a topic area. It kind of, you know, resonates with this subject area that does work for an audience. You know, the problem is, you can't argue with your audience as much as you'd like to. You look at the ratings and you want to say, what idiots, you know, did they know how good this was? And, you know, sometimes we have programs on. There was one program I thought was so awful. We acquired it, because some of our programs we acquired. It's kind of an end of the year program. And I didn't, it was a, there have been three NOVAs in all these years that I just actually never looked at, because I just thought they were so dumb, they made me sick, and I just let my staff deal with it. So I'm on the exercise machine at the gym around Christmas time, and I'm watching this NOVA comes on, and I'm watching it. It's like, this is the stupidest program I've ever seen. This is really horrible. And, you know, and then, you know, I see the ratings come across the next morning. I mean, I was embarrassed about it, and, you know, it does great. And so you can't argue with your viewers. You know, they vote with the clicker. Even though you might like to, sometimes they like programs we think are idiotic. And other times, although we don't like to put on programs that we think are idiotic, but you don't love all your children equally in this.
I think I have a solution for that problem.
Yeah.
I mean, as you said, there's all this wonderful interest in mathematics and physics and biology behind all these processes that you guys in the physics and mathematics of cancer study. Why not just talk about these things without mentioning cancer? I bet you something that at least half of the people in your field would happily be working on these things into the future, even if cancer is cured, because they're excited. Probably 50% of all the audience are secret hypochondriacs that do not want to know all the terrible ways they could die. Just tell them about the wonderful things that you discover in these things, like how cells communicate, how cells do apoptosis and just bring a sunburn, as an example, or not cancer fiber, and they're going to love it, because they don't realize that you tell them how they could go.
I mean, I think that's a great idea. We've done programs. I mean, we did a program called What Darwin Never Knew with Sean Carroll, which is really about gene regulation. And it's kind of like, okay, gene regulation is pretty new. It was very, very difficult science.
Sean Carroll?
It was 2 hours. Sean, not the physics, Sean Carroll.
Yeah. Okay.
One from the University of Wisconsin at HHMI. And it did great. So I agree with you. If you can find some way to make this look like a basic biological process, which when it goes awry can result in cancer, I think you... And this is not something I'm saying I'm never going to do another program on cancer. That would be like a horrible thing to say. And I think that sitting in on a few of these sessions has really helped me to see that there is a program there. But I think that what you say is true. You have to find a way to go about it so that the minute people think about it, they don't really think of somebody getting chemo, because they're just not going to watch it. And, you know, and I mean, some people will, but a lot of people won't. So you can't argue with them. They're not going to watch what they're not going to watch. And unfortunately, there's nothing I can do to make them, which is very, to bad, but that's the way it goes.
What about the, do you have anything like, Burke? What was his first name?
James Burke, Connections.
James Burke, Connections.
So that's my favorite series of all time.
Had a good viewership that must have had.
Yeah, it was a long, long, long time ago.
Right. Is there something, did you do something else like that?
Well, you know, does everybody know about Connections? It's a program out of the UK around 1980, I want to say. I don't think it was that late. I think that was probably a repeat. But it was wonderful, which is James Burke was very energetic British guy. First you'd see him in Greece, then you'd see him in Italy, then you'd see him in Antarctica, and, you know, all tracing these connections that result in graphene, you know, but going like way back to the ancient Greeks. And so that was one of the series
that resources.
But it should be done again. Yeah. It should be done again. I agree with you. That was, I mean, I personally like that better than Cosmos. So
right.
Not everybody agrees with me, but I do. Any other ideas that come to the fore? So let me pitch you, I mean, ask you a couple what you think. Do you think an idea, a show on the Higgs and on the Standard Model would be a good idea? Is that deep enough? Is it rich enough?
Is it the right time?
The right time?
Yeah, that's in the sense that we could have a resolution to at least part of the story fairly soon.
End of the year. That's what they say, right?
End of what?
The standard model Higgs, end of the year. But if it's a non-standard Higgs or something, there are various possibilities here. So I would, my thoughts would be that is a very important question, but it's one where we're just on the cusp of finding something important out.
Very important question, whether the standard model still...
Yeah, whether the standard model still holds, whether there is a Higgs or something else. We seem to be not finding supersymmetry yet, but there's still a lot of place for it to hide.
But either way, the story could totally change in December in the middle of production, which would be disappointing.
The LHC is going to run until the end of the year, and then they're going to shut down for a while because they need to do all those repairs to get it up to 14 or 15. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's all.
Well, that would be the hiatus, yeah.
That's a natural time. Mm-hmm.
It's also not necessarily a happy story, so we don't yet know which direction to pitch it, right?
Well, it may be that they, what if they don't find the standard model Higgs? There are hints at 125 GeV, but it'll be happy for someone. Some people regard that as a discovery, but.
So we should be prepared for a lot of controversy around whatever they say.
There may be a clear signal, in which case everyone will be very excited. Mm-hmm.
But you can't write the story now. That's the problem. Yeah. You don't know.
Yeah, that's very scary when you can't. Okay, what about gravity waves? Is that part of the story on LIGO? Is that a story?
Has there been any recent that I'm not aware of?
I've had that pitched to me by a physicist, and one that I really like.
But what I mean is, gravity waves have been predicted decades and decades and decades ago. We want to see them at some point.
Right.
So is there any new development? Satellites are
getting close. We're getting close on the scale of, I think, years or something. We may well be able to start seeing them. It is a fascinating subject because it opens up a whole new way of looking at the universe, both astrophysical objects and potentially the early universe. So it's a subject with a lot of content.
Mm-hmm. And the devices being developed are certainly remarkable in scope.
They're huge scale. They're miles across and so on.
But it doesn't have any relationship with what we were talking about before about gravity.
No. Small. It's one window, possibly, to the early universe, but that's a little bit of a remote condition.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. These are great ideas. I appreciate it. I'm here for 3 more weeks, so if something comes into your head that you want to talk to me about, my office is first one on the right upstairs, and just come by or leave me a note on the bulletin board, and I'll get in touch with you. So thanks very much, and I'm giving one more talk on the 25th of June on controversy. We'll talk about that.